Golf Today.
Hey, hey, happy Monday. Welcome inside our Golf Channel Worldwide Headquarters. I'm George Savarica, sitting alongside Eamon Lynch. This is Golf Today, here with you for the next couple hours. Pretty cool for golf fans over the weekend on both the LPGA Tour and PGA Tour. We had world number ones going for three straight wins. Pretty amazing stuff.
And the fact that we found out that Scottie Scheffler is mortal, at least appears mortal, on a Sunday afternoon for a change. And this was, to be fair to Scottie Scheffler, this was just okay in terms of his normal statistical brilliance. In Houston, he was just okay, but just okay is enough to give him a five-footer to force a playoff. On a Sunday afternoon, there was nothing just okay about Nelly Korda. I mean, she's on a heck of a run. Scottie didn't get it done. She did, and she's going for four this week.
And she did it in commanding fashion. And with Scottie Scheffler, his base level for where his game is at, when he seemingly had, like, remember Tiger back in the day would say, I had my C stuff and was able to win. It would seem like for Scottie, by his, I mean, incomparably high standards right now with his game, that was maybe his B-minus, C-plus game. And he's right there with a very makeable putt on the 72nd hole to force a playoff.
I think it's fair to say we haven't seen. We all used to roll our eyes when Tiger would say that. Then we realized it was true. I think Scottie Scheffler is the first player we've seen since Tiger Woods where you can legitimately point to their performance numbers and say that wasn't actually his best. That was well shy of his best in some respects, and he's still right there every week on the PGA Tour.
Well, we're taking a second look for what unfolded down the stretch if you weren't glued to your television for the final round of the Texas Children's Houston Open. Scottie Scheffler, buck 85 in, knows he needs to make birdie. This is approach to the 18th, flags it.
That's why he's world number one. Trying to put a little pressure on Steven Yeager.
Yeager also from the middle of the fairway. And he's got to feel just the Sunday juices trying to win for the first time on the PGA Tour. Not a bad response. Yeager with that one-shot lead, Eamon. So he would go first for birdie.
This to win championship. Just slides by the right edge. Tapped in for par. He finished at 12 under.
So that's the number in the clubhouse. Posted at 12. Scottie, you think? Okay, we're going play. Oh, oh! Slides by on the left. Did not see that happening. Yeager got to be surprised, but breathing a sigh of relief as he wins for the first time on the PGA Tour. The reaction, though, to that missed putt on the 72nd hole.
What are you thinking on 18 when Scottie's lining up for that putt and what's your mental process, going through there?
Where to hit it in the playoff on the green. I've always kind of been taught that was a match play situation at that point, right? So I missed my putt, and you expect your opponent to make a chip or putt, whatever it is. So that was my mindset, and, he's the best player in the world. I think he was expecting to make it too. I got lucky that he didn't, but he'll be back. I'm not worried about him at all.
Stop me if you heard this before. Another first-time winner on the PGA Tour, and we've had a slew of them so far early this season. That's been the narrative, aside from the little back-to-back that Scottie Scheffler had on the Florida swing. There have been a whole host of players who have had their big breakthrough this season on the PGA Tour. Steven Yeager adds his name to the list, and here's what the win meant to Yeager and his family.
I have three ball markers in my bag that my wife made me. One, my son Fritz is on the name with a four-leaf clover. One is my dog Phil. And when I pulled it out, I always pull it out not knowing which one I pulled out. I pulled my dad's one out. It says Papa Klaus. So he obviously passed away a couple of years ago, the week of the Players. And that was probably the low part of my life. I was playing terrible golf. And the silver lining in that story is my son was conceived that week. That was kind of that you lose a life and you gain a life, right? And he'd be rolling over right now, happy. But we miss him. And my mom's coming over next week, so we'll celebrate with her a little bit. It'll be great.
Was your dad's passing part of kind of
the desire to change your kind of mental attitude overall?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think that and the birth of my son, two of the things where I felt like, hey, you know what, this is just golf. It's so hard sometimes. We want to make it way more than it is, but on the end of the day, you know, like I said, you still have a family to come back to. They still love you. You know, there's worse things in golf than not winning a golf tournament or missing the cut. So,
all right. Anything else?
One, the ball marker. When did you pull out your dad's ball marker?
This morning. I always pull them out before the round, and that's whoever I pull out. That's the one I use for the day. And it was my son the first 3 days, and was my dad today, and I just kind of smiled. And you know, when you kind of said earlier, what was a good omen for the day? That was my good omen for the day for sure.
Must have been a great omen for the day for Stephen Yeager.
We use a lot more perspective like that in this game these days. The idea that losing a golf tournament or not winning isn't the worst thing that could possibly happen to you.
It's always great to hear when a player is introspective, but then vulnerable enough to share their perspective on what the game means and then how they balance that with life outside the ropes.
And this is a guy who, by normal standards, is quite accomplished. He's won six times on the Korn Ferry Tour. He shot 58 out there. He's a guy who's been put in high-pressure situations repeatedly and closed the deal. He just hadn't done it on this stage. And when you look at the script for yesterday, there were a multitude of reasons why it should not have been Stephen Yeager. At the end of the day, you know, he's a guy who was, he'd never been in that position before on the PGA Tour. He's going up against the world number one. He's going up against the world number one in his home state. He's going up against the world number one in his home state in form. There were a lot of reasons why you would have thought someone else was going to hold that trophy at the end of the day. And there would always be people who'd say, well, this is a recurring thing on the tour, that the guys who are the lesser mortals are winning and superstars ought to be doing it and stepping up. To me, this is a sign of the depth of talent that exists out there. We talk about all the guys with all the major titles. He held up yesterday. This is a guy who's only played four majors in his entire career, only two of them in the last 5 years. And he's good enough to face down the world number one when it mattered.
Well, yeah, and Yeager had been stuck kind of in that yo-yo bounce back of tour back to Korn Ferry, tour back to Korn Ferry. He was, though, if you remember, a big part of the storyline at the Farmers Insurance Open in that final group on Sunday, played fairly well. Matthew Pavon just, I mean, finished with a flourish down the stretch to get his first win. For Yeager, it's been a part of this trend that has taken time. And we're so used to players making an immediate splash on the PGA Tour where they seemingly make it look easy. And we think, okay, the transition from amateur golf to Korn Ferry to the PGA Tour is just this three-prong progression where guys immediately win. That's such a small subset of players that follow that trajectory. For a lot of guys, it takes time to acclimate to the Korn Ferry Tour or to then the PGA Tour. And I bumped into Stephen in an airport like 4 months ago. We had some time to kill on a layover. We're just chit-chatting. And I said, you cashed a lot of checks last year. We had that extended season, 22-23. He made 33 starts, only missed three cuts. Made 30 out of 33 cuts, but he said, okay, the next step is I've made a ton of cuts, is to start contending with more regularity so I know how I'm going to react when I'm in the cauldron of a Sunday in contention trying to win on the PGA Tour. I think Torrey had a big impact for how he looked at the Texas Children's Houston Open. And the next thing to keep an eye on, he's all the way up to 43rd in the world golf rankings, the next highest ranked German is outside the top 100. So he's all but locked up a spot to play in the Olympic Games, which would be huge for him. And while he played his college golf in Tennessee and has made his home here, very proud of his kind of German heritage. And I know he'd love to be part of the Paris Summer Olympics as well. So he's now, I mean, has the best ranking in his career, already has a win this season. Now he can recalibrate what his goal setting will look like for the rest of the season leading up to the Olympics.
And we're finally seeing a return on the investment he put in over the last couple of years. It's very easy for a guy who makes a lot of checks to just continue making a lot of checks and not try to figure out where the next ascension point is. But he worked a lot on his mental game with a new coach. He worked a lot on his physicality and on his swing speed. And he led the field in driving distance yesterday. No one was longer out there than Stefan Yeager all the way right up to the final hole. He put himself in position based on the work that he put in. He's not remotely complacent. And as we just saw in his public comments there after, that's the kind of attitude that I think fans want to see a little bit more of in this game these days. A guy who appreciates where he is, he's willing to work for it, he expects the results of himself, and when he was given his moment to shine, he took it.
And it's so often we see someone come up just short and say, okay, well, they'll learn from that, and the next time, under pressure, they'll deliver. But a lot of times, scar tissue builds up. Yeah. Where the inverse could happen, where it could become more challenging, because then you start thinking, well, I've come up short. These negative thoughts enter your mind. So it was fun to see as a golf fan the almost immediate bounce back that he had from earlier this year on the West Coast swing to then win in Texas before the Masters and shore up a tee time for Augusta and what could be a pretty big season for him going forward.
The Augusta National Women's Amateur is upon us, one of the most prestigious titles in the game. First round coverage begins Wednesday at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time right here on Golf Channel. The 2021 Augusta National Women's Amateur runner-up Emilia Miliaccio will make her fifth appearance in the championship this week. 3 years ago, she closed with a final round 70 at Augusta National before losing in a playoff to Japan's Tsubasa Kajitani.
And what a decorated amateur career Miliaccio has had. You remember back in 2022, she was a member of the winning U.S. Curtis Cup team for the second consecutive year. And the U.S. team absolutely rolled, winning 15.5 to 4.5 over Great Britain and Ireland. These the 42nd playing of the Curtis Cup matches. Then a year later, she helped Wake Forest Demon Deacons take care of USC to win the NCAA Division I Women's Golf Championship. That was her fifth and final season on the team. Miliaccio winning her match 4-2 as the Deacs became national champions. And how about that? She was also pulling double duty. Miliaccio grabbing a microphone and was part of the Golf Channel broadcast, which we've seen her the past couple years at Golf Channel now as an on-course reporter and an analyst. So now a player as well as a media member. So our colleague Emilio Miliaccia joins us now. Emilia, like Eamon mentioned, this is going to be your fifth appearance in the Augusta National Women's Amateur. What's the buildup like now compared to the inaugural one that you played in?
Well, you mentioned my broadcasting career that I've been now working full-time for Golf Channel and PGA Tour Live, but I took a couple of weeks off these last 2 weeks preparing for the Augusta National Women's Amateur, so it's been really nice to focus on pretty much just one thing. I'm thinking a little bit about the drive, chip, and putt that I'm going to call on later this on Sunday, but it's been really exciting. I've played a lot, just really trying to dial in my scores in an actual round. When I've been on the road broadcasting, I've had time to practice in between breaks and stuff, but haven't really had those big grind sessions that I'm used to in college. And preparing for the inaugural tournament in 2019, that's really what I was doing. So just getting back into the form of things, and it's been really exciting. I've been posting some low rounds, so now it's just a matter of translating that into competition.
You do compete fairly sparingly these days, Emilia. Is it tough to have expectations coming into a week like this when you're not as competitively sharp as you have been in years past?
I think my expectations will always remain high, and especially because I've really been seeing a lot of positives and where my game is trending. But yes, you're completely right in the sense when you're not competing week in and week out, it can be hard to have the same expectations. Maybe you put some more pressure on yourself, but I'm really trying to normalize that a little bit, that I maybe haven't competed since January. I don't really compete a lot anymore, but I have competed for most of my life and I have a lot to lean on. That's really what I'm focused on going into this week.
How has your perspective shifted when you are in competition inside the ropes after the last couple of years holding a microphone?
I think I've learned so much from just watching players on the amateur circuit, LPGA Tour and PGA Tour, just how they handle themselves, how they warm up, how they carry themselves on the golf course, course management wise. I mean, there's a lot of things that I've learned from them. And I think I've just gained a lot of experience and maturity. And going into this week, I want to play well, of course, but I'm also really focused on enjoying the time with my family, seeing a lot of friends that I haven't seen in a while, and just really soaking up the week. And hopefully that means I'm playing on Saturday.
I want you to keep the analyst hat on for a moment, Amelia. We focus so much on Augusta National, but Champions Retreat has proven that it's no pushover at all for the first couple of rounds of this championship every year. What is the skill set necessary for players to actually advance out of the play there to get their way to Augusta National?
It's a ball striker's golf course, Champions Retreat. It can be quite long on some of the holes, so having really good iron play, getting the driver in the fairway is really important, because if you start missing the greens are really fast and the up and downs can be tricky. So I think the player that makes it up to Saturday and has a chance at winning is hitting their irons close. And then also the greens can be quite firm, so you're not going to have as many 6 footers, really close shots for birdie, even if you're having a wedge in hand. So you also need to make those 10 to 15 footers as well, and maybe 20, 25 feet. So I think those are the things that are going to be really important and something that I'm going to be focused on as well for the week.
Amelia, we knew with the advent of the Augusta National Women's Amateur that this would be a high-profile event. How has the cachet evolved over time?
I don't know how they continue to get better and better, the Augusta National Women's Amateur, but they do. The way they treat us, the way they greet us with a beautiful tournament gift to start when we check in, and just all the things that they've added into the tournament. We get to play the par 3 course now on Friday. Everyone gets a chance to play the practice round at Augusta National on Friday, and then they've added the par 3. They have the chairman's dinner tomorrow, which we all get really excited about. It's super formal, and we get to meet just so many great people. I mean, the folks that are members at Augusta National are just at the top of their industry and have so much wisdom and great stories to tell, and just you really can lean on them for so much advice and just learning experiences. So it's truly been incredible. I get so excited for this year, as everyone does. We all talk about it, especially in January when everyone starts getting their invitations in the mail. So it's just been so impressive to see what the Augusta National Women's Amateur has done and how they accommodate for the players. It's truly incredible.
Yeah, that excitement you have is very apparent right now. You've made clear you don't want to play this game for a living, but when you're here in a week like this and you feel this kind of vibe heading into the championship, does it make you want to kind of rethink it at all?
It's funny. I'm in one of those situations where I love to compete. I've always loved to compete. I just don't like the lifestyle of professional golf, or just not something that I want to do full time. But when I'm in a situation like this week at the Augusta National Women's Amateur, I'm all in. I've been telling people that it's been so fun to be a professional athlete for 2 weeks and just focus on golf. I don't want to just focus on golf my entire life. So that's why I'm in broadcasting and doing 20 things at once usually. And I love to do that. But yeah, when you're at a golf course like Champions Retreat and Augusta National, you're playing on the most pristine conditions. It makes me really excited to compete, and yeah, I'm just really gonna soak it in.
Amelia, good to spend some time with you. Play well this week at the Augusta National Women's Amateur. Time now for a Golf Today roundtable, and let's welcome in the aforementioned Golf Channel senior writer Ryan Lavner and Golf Digest senior writer Joel Beal. Lav, we'll start with you. Shaping up to be a big summer for Steven Yeager. First the win, now likely the Olympics as well. What was the bigger takeaway? Him getting his big breakthrough on Sunday, or world number one Scottie Scheffler's miss on the 72nd hole?
Yeah, no disrespect to Steven Yeager, obviously. I mean, a player who won 6 times on the Korn Ferry Tour and then finally gets his first win on the PGA Tour in 135 starts should be applauded for his perseverance. But to me, the biggest takeaway with Scottie Scheffler, especially as we now have our eyes on next week's Masters tournament. I mean, the storyline A, B, and C heading into the Masters is who can beat Scottie Scheffler. He proved, obviously, in Houston that he is not infallible, but I think it's almost inevitable that he will be in contention. You guys talked about it in the first segment. Like, what was that, his B-minus game, his C game? He wasn't top five off the tee, approach, scrambling, or putting. It's obviously very un-Scottie Scheffler-like, and yet he still almost won the golf tournament. I can't help but think, you know, as we look ahead to Augusta National and being in the media building there, if the conversation would have been a little bit uncomfortable for Scottie Scheffler had he won, had he gone to the Masters gunning for 4 in a row, some of the Tiger-like comparisons, some of the the talk that's going to be kind of putting him on a future trajectory. Scottie Scheffler has always sort of batted away those types of suggestions, but had he won, I think the conversation could have been a little bit different.
Joel, Ryan said he almost won the golf tournament. Almost is the key word there, and the manner in which it was almost, I think, is key. Do you buy the argument that there's no scar tissue that comes out of what happened yesterday, not just on that final hole, but during the course of the day yesterday where he putted so poorly, and in fact in half of the tournament days he was negative strokes gained putting? Is there still a little question mark around that as we head to Augusta for you?
A little question mark, but to me, if anything, Augusta's greens help him more than hurt him, because they're so tough it sort of mitigates any advantages any player has when it comes to putting, and really emphasizes the importance of tee to green game, which Scheffler has shown the past, what, 2.5 seasons, he's historically dominant in that facet of the game. Certainly you would like to see the putting be a little bit better heading into the biggest tournament of the year, but no, nothing that we saw over the weekend, at least in my mind, lowers the ceiling of what this guy can do next week.
Hard to argue to the contrary with, just where Scottie Scheffler's game is at, and then the margin from where he is at world number one to Rory McIlroy at world number two. Switching gears, and this flew a little bit under the radar at the Houston Open, but got some traction on social media. Tony Finau, who's about as easygoing as they come, he and Alejandro Tosti had, I could call it maybe a testy exchange. We know a bit of the backstory, Lav, with Tosti on the Korn Ferry Tour, and had a multi-event suspension for some of his behavior inside the ropes. It seemed like this was almost a throwback to what we used to see maybe in the 80s and 90s, where there could be some gamesmanship inside the ropes and guys trying to get under each other's skin. What did you think about what occurred on that fourth green with Tosti and Finau, Lav?
I think it just underscored the interview that J.C. Deacon did, who's the Florida head coach, and obviously he coached Alejandro Tosti when he was in college. And J.C. Deacon appeared on Golf Central on Saturday night, and he said that Alejandro Tosti is not scared of anyone. He's not there to make friends. He almost seems like he's at war with both himself and his competitors inside the ropes. To me, that immediately evoked in my mind a player like Patrick Reed, who very much had a similar personality. Again, you know, that might not ingratiate himself to his peers, but I think Alejandro Tosti, in my experience, and I used to cover him in college, like, he's better in one-on-one situations away from the golf course, away from that competitive arena, just as Patrick Reed, in my experience, was better away from the golf course and in those one-on-one experiences. At some point, that player wants you to respect his talent and respect his achievements. Again, it's going to grate on certain people, and it was certainly a surprise to see a PGA Tour rookie take on Tony Finau, who's arguably the most likable player on the PGA Tour. But that's his personality, Alejandro Tosti is, and I hope we see more of it.
Does the Tour need to embrace things like this, Joel, or do fans need to celebrate it? Because it seems as though all the villains, all the guys that people used to root against, for better or worse, kind of left to go to the LIV Tour. This guy has promised that he might actually bring a little bit of villainy, a little bit of edge back to the Tour.
I think you just said it. It's celebrate. I'm not sure even so much what he has as an edge as it's just having some character in a sport that tends to be very vanilla, right? I think as golf gets to know Al Tosti, he is someone that should be celebrated. He came from nothing. He was playing with a stick and a ping pong ball growing up. He had to take a bus ride for an hour just to go practice. Yeah, he's an old school shot maker in this game where we've fallen into this TrackMan era. And you never have to guess what he's thinking, because he's going to tell you. My worry, I think, because of all the weighty philosophical things that we've been dealing with the past couple of years, we've sort of lost sight that so many of golf's central actors tend to be this cookie cutter variety. And what's worse, when someone is a little bit different, we tend to ostracize them. Bryson DeChambeau, he brought a lot of criticism on himself, but he also really didn't stand a chance. So I think as Tosti begins to make himself more well-known, I hope fans don't focus on whatever perceived peccadilloes or oddities he have, and instead kind of look at these traits as something that can really make golf, something that golf desperately needs right now.
Well, somebody else that golf desperately needs these days, Lav, would seem to me to be Jordan Spieth. Obviously an engaging character. People tend to live and die, even on social media, with every shot the guy hits. But his last four starts, he's got a DQ, a couple of missed cuts, tied for 30th, I think. How much does he need to find something this week? Or does it not really matter with a guy like that when he turns down Magnolia Lane that he seems to find some elixir that's missing the rest of the time?
Yeah, I'm not so sure that his performance this week at the Valero Texas Open is going to be any sort of indicator of what he's going to do next week at Augusta National. It's been kind of a weird year for Jordan Spieth. I think that's actually how he described it a couple of weeks ago at the Valspar Championship. Like, he had a chance to win at the Century at the beginning of the year. He was inside the top 10 before he doubled the final hole on Friday at the Genesis, and then obviously was disqualified for signing his incorrect scorecard. So he's had a bunch of hit and misses. If you look at his statistics, like, he's putting exceptionally well, but his wedge play, which is traditionally one of the hallmarks of his game, has been a little bit shoddy, so to speak. So it's been, you know, from the flu to the driver breaking to sort of these ups and downs. He never plays particularly well at the Players' Championship. I think it's easy to dismiss, but I think it's really easy to dismiss. We look at his record at Augusta National. In all the times that the Masters has been held in April, when Jordan Spieth has played, he has just one finish worse than tie for 21st. And so that's a place where his imagination really shines, his shot making really shines. I would expect Jordan Spieth to be very much in the picture next week at the Masters. But again, he has to be load sharper if he wants to take on Scottie Scheffler and the like.
And it was 2021 when he entered that winless drought on the PGA Tour at Valero and then went on to finish T3 at the Masters shortly thereafter. Guys, we still have more to get to on this roundtable on the other side of the short break. Some comments from Chris DeMarco on the PGA Tour champions welcoming the public investment fund, saying he wants bigger purses. Should they have bigger purses on the PGA Tour champions? We'll debate next.
Continuing our Golf Today roundtable with our two Easter bunnies in their matching lavender here. Joel Beal from Golf Digest, Ryan Lavner from Golf Channel. Joel, Chris DeMarco made some news last week for the first time in quite a while. He had some choice comments saying the Champions Tour, he wanted to see a live takeover, that these guys needed more money out there. It was ridiculous that players at TPC Sawgrass made more money than the entire purses of Champions Tour events. He didn't get any public support from any of his peers on the Champions Tour, and I heard from a few who felt quite differently. Does he have a valid argument and bad timing, or is it just a bad argument?
I think it's a bad argument and bad timing. To DeMarco's credit, I think his comments were said in jest, and this is sort of the problem with our aggregation media culture at the moment. We focus on a headline rather than the context of what was being said. In that same breath, certainly very bad timing, because there's a lesson in this reaction. It's that fans have been beaten down by talks of money and worth and just the overall sentiment of greed that has been at the forefront of professional golf the past 2 years. And at some point, this apathy we've seen from fans this past year, it's going to turn into abandonment. There are other sports to watch. Unlike other professional games, professional sports, we can play golf rather than just watch it. So I think for those in the game, they really need to be careful about what they say, especially when it comes to the Champions Tour, right? You look at other sports, most people are done after 4 or 5 years. The PGA Tour already gives a runway of 10 to 20, even 30 years of earning a living. And now with the PGA Tour champions, you kind of have this golden parachute. You would like to see your athletes be a little bit more thankful. So even though DeMarco was in jest and you knew they were taken out of context, you just have to be careful when joking on a subject like this.
And I mean, for the future of the PGA Tour champions, so much is dependent on the unknown variable of, will we see Tiger? If so, how many times, and what his future plans are going forward once he turns the big 5-0. Lav, on the DP World Tour, Keith Nakajima gets the win last week, and one of the first things he says in the kind of the winner's interview after was, my goal is to play on this tour and try and finish among the top 10 so I can get a spot on the PGA Tour. Is this helpful or hurtful that this is such a big part now of guys' motivation to play the DP World Tour?
I still maintain that it's actually helpful for these players. You know, the partnership between the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour, the strategic alliance, has kind of made official what we've known now for years, if not decades, and that's the best players want to play in the United States. There's the most money here on the PGA Tour, the most commercial opportunities, the most talent, and outgoing CEO Keith Pelley was roundly criticized for this move, when I think he should actually be commended. Rather than the members trying to, you know, boost the world ranking to get into the top 50 and be eligible for the major championships or get on the PGA Tour or kind of scrape by collecting sponsor exemptions. He is now providing a direct path from the European Tour to the PGA Tour for the top 10 performers. We've already seen how that has benefited some players, including Matthew Pavon, who won the Farmers Insurance Open. So I don't understand the criticism. If you're a member of the DP World Tour, you should love that this option is now available to you.
So, guys, Tiger was in Augusta at the weekend, played a practice round, reportedly with Justin Thomas. Give me your best prediction for next week. What's more likely, a top 10 or a top 20, say, or a missed cut? What do you predict, Joel?
I would go with missed cut, because the reality is he's played four rounds of an official tournament, I think, just twice in the last 4 years. I think the problem is, because Tiger has proved before that he can be the player that he once was, people just think that this is always going to happen. That's just going to be the cycle, how it's always going to be. And this sport remains woefully unprepared to acknowledge that Woods of the past, even Woods of 2019, is likely not coming back. Now, I don't think Tiger has any appetite to be a ceremonial player. So if he's in the field, I think there's a realistic chance he can make the cut. And as he says, if he can make the cut, he's got a shot. We've kind of had a low-key stretch of undramatic Sunday Masters, so maybe there could be whatever news from Magic, and that is how you hedge, my friends.
I think the most likely scenario is kind of what we've seen in this small sample size as Tiger returned from the lower right leg injuries in 2022. That's somewhere between like a 30th place finish and a 50th place finish. He's made the cut at the Masters in far worse physical condition than apparently he is right now. I'm also probably not the best person to ask, because I walked with Tiger Woods during his practice rounds and during his Pro-Am round at Riviera ahead of the Genesis. And I actually thought he looked quite good. And then he has the quote-unquote muscle spasm during the opening round. He gets sick on Friday, and we have not seen him since, when you would have thought that if he was in the best physical condition possible and he was kind of targeting this once a month playing cadence, that he would have teed it up at the Players Championship. And so I don't think we really know. I do think it's reasonable to expect that he can make the cut at Augusta National, just kind of based on his golf course IQ and based on his guile, but he's nowhere near sharp enough to top 10 finish in the year's first major.
He teases you with maybe stretches of six holes, nine holes, maybe a round here or there, but to see 4 days out of Tiger Woods, or six if you include the lead up to the Masters, where his body holds up each and every day and we have the right weather conditions, it's just such a fine line for that to happen. He's Golf Digest, Joel Beal, Ryan Lavner with Golf Channel. Guys, thanks for being part of the Golf Channel Roundtable.
Thanks. Got it.
Well, no competitor at the Augusta National Women's Amateur has more experience of life at the glamorous end of Magnolia Lane than our next guest. Megha Ganne is playing for the fourth time to go along with four drive, chip and putt finalist appearances. She's coming up right after this break.
And Megha Ganne, the Stanford University sophomore, will make, get this, her fourth appearance in the Augusta National Women's Amateur in 2023. She advanced to the final round, wound up among the top 10, finishing T9 at Augusta. And before her debut in this championship, 2021, she was a four-time drive, chip, and putt national finalist at Augusta National, competing in 2015, 17, 18, and 19. She was runner-up in the girls' 12-13 division in 2017 and in the 2019 girls' 14 and 15 division. So with that, we have Megha Ganne joining us now. And Megha, it looks like you're live on scene as the countdown is on until the Augusta National Women's Amateur. Where are you right now?
I am at Champions Retreat, standing at the practice facility.
And, I mean, what's the excitement like when the countdown goes from weeks, months, to now days as you're with your practice round, gearing up for the event?
Yeah, just a few days left. You can definitely feel the excitement on the grounds. And the first shuttle took off the hotel at 11:30, and everyone was lined up to get on that one. So a lot of excitement in the air and just finishing touches before the first round on Wednesday.
And the first round of Champions Retreat and the second round has often proved difficult for players over the years, Megha. It's a very difficult golf course. Your first two appearances, you missed the cut, didn't qualify for that competitive round at Augusta National. Last year, You tied ninth there. What was it like to finally make it through, to step on that first tee at Augusta National in a competitive setting?
Yeah, I wanted it really badly last year. And this course definitely proves challenging for me and I think a lot of people. And a lot of people think that Champions Retreat is more difficult than Augusta National. So it's a great test to find that top 30 that moves on to that final round. So I think more loops around this place is very helpful. So I feel really good about this year because familiarity definitely helps you for these first few days.
What boxes do you need to check the next couple of days to think my game's in the ideal spot for where it needs to be once play starts?
Yeah, just getting loose, feeling warm, and then a lot of short game chips and putts, getting used to the speed of these greens. Just having a good feel around the greens, that's the key around here. So that's where I'll be spending most of my time.
You said familiarity matters. You're talking about Champions Retreat, but it also matters down the road at Augusta National. Mega, how important was it for you over the years to have been there for the drive, chip and putt finals just to be able to soak up the atmosphere so you didn't feel completely alien when you first got there?
Yeah, it's really cool. It's my family has spent spring break here for like the last 8 years now, maybe going on, 8 years. So I feel super familiar on the entire downtown Augusta area and Augusta National, which not a lot of people can say. So I'm definitely very lucky. And that final round, definitely every bit of comfort will help you when you're playing in front of those crowds at the final round at Augusta. So I'll take it.
Megan, you get on the national radar as a 17-year-old high school student. You had the opening round lead at Olympic for the U.S. Women's Open. You were T3 going into the final round, finished T14 for the week. How does that experience playing on such a massive stage help you when you're playing in the Augusta National Women's Amateur?
Super similar. I mean, it's just round after round, more high-pressure situations you can get yourself into. It's going to help you down the road and layering those levels of high-level events and pressure and learning from the best of the world. It only adds to my experience. And, I feel really good as a player knowing that I have some of those experiences under my belt.
But fans have such an intimate knowledge of Augusta National, Mega. They know the holes. Is there any particular hole or any stretch of holes out there that you think have been problematic for you in your past appearances here?
Not yet. So hopefully I can keep it that way. But I actually really like Augusta, and I think I fare pretty well there every time that I've played. So hoping to keep that going. I really love the stretch of 10, 11, 12. So those are my favorite holes. I don't have any least favorites yet.
Well, that's the right attitude to carry into this week. Best of luck. We'll certainly be watching you at the Augusta National Women's Amateur.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Obviously, three straight wins and three straight starts. What's been different maybe mentally for you on the golf course that's really helped you to the success?
I don't really know. Just really enjoying myself out there. I love golf. I've always loved golf. I mean, sometimes it's harder than other days. Last year was definitely one of the harder years. I never really got any momentum going with injuries and such the past 2 years, in all honesty. And I would say the reset that I had after Bradenton really, really helped me. I really enjoyed my time off, spent a lot of time with my family, went back to Prague, enjoyed kind of life outside of golf a little, just disconnected. And to me, that was just like the perfect reset going into this like busy schedule.
And my Golf Week colleague, Bethan Nichols, joins us now. Bethan, we've just heard Nelly Korda talk about last year being a difficult year with injuries, a very kind of stop-start season for her. She skipped the entire Asian swing on the LPGA Tour earlier this year. Before she began this winning streak, she'd been off for 7 weeks. How much is freshness a factor right now, you think?
I think it's massive, but not just physically. You know, mentally, I think maybe is even more important because for the first time that she can remember in a long time, this wasn't a forced break. She wasn't sitting on the sidelines because of an injury where, you know, mentally that can do a whole lot of things to you, but that she chose to do this. And so you approach it in a totally different way. So I think spending that time in Prague with her grandparents and just putting the clubs away for a while gave her a nice reset and obviously coming off of a win, you have nothing but good memories going into your next event.
Bethann, we've seen her have some monster seasons before on the LPGA Tour. Could this shape up to be arguably the best season of her career?
Well, goodness, she still has a lot to go in terms of winning a major and a gold medal to get back to what we saw in 2021. But she looks amazing. I mean, I don't see any weakness in her game right now. You know, in fact, when we just look at, I think, the maturity that we're seeing now from just 3 years ago, I remember early on in that season when she won at Lake Nona, she's like, gosh, this is so tiring. I don't know how people win two and three tournaments in a row, you know, and now it looks like she's done it a million times and we don't hear her saying anything like that. So, you know, she definitely has, you know, just grown and matured as a person and a player. And I loved what she had to say yesterday about working with Jason, her caddy, down the stretch, you know, that they don't take on unnecessary risk anymore as much as they used to, which we saw down the stretch when she pulled that 7-wood on the drivable par 4 16 and secured a fairly easy-looking birdie.
On the 18th green, she told Kay Cockerell that she hasn't really thought at all about the other historical winning streaks of players like Joanne Carner, Nancy Lopez, or anyone else. Do you believe her?
I do believe her on that front because I think she probably was completely unaware of those streaks. I'm just guessing there. But just judging by players in general and how much history they know, that probably all came as a surprise to her. But when she says that she doesn't think about the Hall of Fame, then I'm like, well, I don't know about that. I'm guessing that probably does come into her mind from time to time, especially with all this talk about Lydia Ko and the Hall of Fame. How can it not?
Yeah, good look at the last four instances that we saw players win three consecutive starts on the LPGA. Last American was back in the 80s, so it had been a minute since we had seen that. Bethann, we were having the debate last week on the PGA Tour. Does the men's side need a dominant player? Well, we're seeing a dominant stretch right now from Nelly Korda. Does the LPGA Tour need a clearly dominant player for the women's game?
1,000% and 1,000,000%. However big of a number I can come up with, the LPGA needs that. And they don't just need a dominant player. They need a dominant player who transcends and people want to talk about. And that's Nelly Korda. When you look at her entire family and how incredibly talented they are, she's the perfect candidate to have people talking about her in a way that we see Caitlin Clark. So we can only hope that we'll see a monster season from Nelly, and not only will she be in the winner's circle a lot, but that she'll say yes to a lot of opportunities after she does get in that winner's circle. When she does win a major championship, that she'll go on a media tour, or do the same after she wins an Olympic gold medal again. I'd really love to see her embrace that.
Do you think she wants that part of it, Bethann? I mean, it's tough to live with the scrutiny, and she's clearly the dominant player and the face of the women's game in the performance sense, the marketing sense is very different. Do you get a sense of a little standoffishness in Nelly's part in not wanting to be scrutinized or kind of taken over as public property in that way?
Certainly. I think she is a reluctant star is how I would describe her. She's not a person who really wants the spotlight, you know, and, you know, the very fact that she skipped her press conference at the British Open after she won the gold medal, that was her next start. Just, you know, shows you how much this just isn't her thing. She'll do it, but it's not like she can't wait to get in there and talk to the media, you know. And once she gets going, she's great. But, you know, it's not like a Nancy Lopez where, you know, you really felt like Nancy felt like that was her obligation and her duty to do for the tour. I feel like, you know, Nelly's going to have to grow into feeling that way.
You say the women's game needs a dominant player in Nelly Korda. In sport, usually you want to see a rivalry emerge. So of the challengers, who's best equipped to go on a run and maybe even push Nelly to potentially even higher heights?
Well, we thought that was going to be Jin-Young Ko, but once again, you know, Jin-Young Ko has had so many injuries that have taken her out of the mix that we haven't been able to see that from her. I don't really think it's going out on a limb to say Lydia Ko might be that player this year because she's just so highly motivated to get that next point. And I don't know how much we're going to see Lydia play beyond when she qualifies for the Hall of Fame. I certainly think if she gets that this season, that she'll finish the year. But I would love to see what we saw in Bradenton earlier in the year of Nelly and Lydia going back and forth throughout the rest of 2024. At least if we could have that, that'd be a great taste.
This is one of the longest conversations we've had in the last few years without really mentioning in detail Jin Young Ko. She was the Nelly Korda rival a couple of years ago. We thought it was going to be that rivalry. When are we going to see her next? We haven't seen a great deal of positive stuff over the last year, year and a half.
Well, I think she's struggling with injuries even still. So I expect to see her at the Chevron. Hopefully she'll be back to 100%. But, you know, it's the same thing that we're seeing now with Lilia Vu. Unfortunately, we've seen so many players have such great runs, and then it's like they hit a giant, you know, speed bump with their bodies. And that's what's happening with Lilia Vu right now too, with all these back spasms that, you know, depending on the weather, the day, you know, she just doesn't know when it's going to come and go. So she has a whole team of folks around her trying to keep her healthy. So hopefully she'll feel that way too, going into Chevron.
Up this week, we have an event I look forward to as a nice change of pace, the T-Mobile match play at Shadow Creek. Is there a certain style of play that's favored this week? Whose game do you like?
Nelly?
Okay, I figured.
Mean, right? I mean, Nelly's game suits any course. You know, but this typically has been, you know, such a marathon week. And obviously the format changing now with stroke play, then narrowing it down to just a handful of players, eight players going into match play. So that's new. And I like that. I think it'll be a lot easier for fans to follow. And I think it's a great kind of warm up going into a Solheim Cup year again. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I just think it used to be, you know, a lot more about stamina, and Nelly's probably going to be a little tired after this run, but wouldn't it be fun to see her at least get into match play and make a run at it?
Let's go to the unpaid ranks for a moment, Bethann. You're going to be part of our live from the Augusta National Women's Amateur coverage this week. What are the storylines, or is there one in particular that you're really looking forward to seeing play out this week?
Well, I think it's a wide open week. You know, I think last year everything was about Rose Zhang, and understandably so. She was the one everybody had their eyes on. And now it definitely feels like a whole host of players could win this thing, that if you can just get past Champions Retreat, you know, you have a chance. And a lot of players will say that Champions Retreat actually feels like the tougher test by the time they get to Augusta National, which is hard for everyone to wrap their heads around. But a lot of players say that. So, you know, I think that, you know, we have a lot. Obviously, Ingrid Lindblad is the biggest name, a 14-time winner now at LSU in her fifth season. No question about it. She stayed amateur to play this one more time and try to win it. She has the perfect ball flight, the perfect game to suit Augusta National. But, you know, there are a lot of players, including juniors, that I think could make a run at this, much like Anna Davis did. You know, Yana Wilson certainly comes to mind. This is a player who won on the Cactus Tour earlier this year. She was the AJGA Player of the Year last year. She was contending in an Epson Tour event. And then she got injured and her caddy passed away. So she actually was playing great earlier this year on that tour. So, you know, I really feel like that was a tragic week, and she was playing exceptional despite some really trying circumstances. So, you know, I think Yana is definitely a player to watch. There are seven players from the top 10 last year are back. So now that this is the fifth edition of the Augusta National Women's Amateur, you know, there's a lot of experience out there.
Yeah, there certainly is. She is Golf Week's Bethann Nichols. Bethann, appreciate it.
Thank you.
School of Golf made its debut on Golf Channel back in 2011. Now one of the longest tenured video instruction series with more than, get this, 400 episodes. Martin Hall and Blair O'Neill present golf drills and technical direction in a fun and engaging manner that's very approachable for the average golfer. A golf pro for more than 40 years, Hall has received numerous awards for his instruction and dedication to the game of golf, while O'Neill, a two-time NCAA long drive champion, played professional golf on various tours and was the champion, if you remember, of Big Break Prince Edward Island. That was the 11th season of the popular Big Break reality series on Golf Channel. We have Martin and Blair joining us now as season 14 is underway. First seven episodes they've dropped and are streaming on Golf Pass. So, Martin, let's start with you. Could you have ever imagined being here at season 14 when the show began all the way back in 2011?
Absolutely not, categorically. I actually thought when I had the chance to do it, maybe I would do eight shows. And here we are, 400-plus climbing. So it's been an incredible ride, George. It's been amazing.
Blair, you still make competitive appearances in this game. And I'm curious, since I'm thinking of auditioning Martin as the sought-after role of my next swing whisperer, does he make you a better golfer being there as his co-host on the show?
Absolutely. I mean, working on the show, it's amazing because, you know, I always tell everyone who watches the show, there's so many tips that we give you throughout a show, but it's really great. If you can pick one or two tips that resonate with you at that time in your game, it's really going to help you. And so I feel like when I have an event coming up, I will kind of pick a tip or two that we've worked on throughout the show that helps me with whatever it is I'm working on that game or to help me that week to play. So it's nice to have, your pick of tips and feel what works best for you.
Martin, you said originally you were going for eight shows. You're at 400 now. What's the secret to keep the instruction fresh after doing this for so many years?
Well, rule number one, golf is very difficult. Don't know if you knew that, but actually it's very difficult. And I still actually teach for a living. People have seen me on the screen so often, they think this is what I do. This is sort of like my little sideline. I still teach a lot. I still teach a lot of, shall we say, you know, normal club golf is anything from 10 handicap to 30 handicap. So the difficulty of the game never escapes me. I've never found it easy. And so I'm always looking to try and put it in digestible terms that might help people make some marginal gains on this game. And it always has done. And to this day, it fascinates me how you can reorganize someone's thoughts or their feels or how they're trying to solve a problem and improve golf. And the reason I've done it so long and haven't stopped is I believe every golfer, no matter what age or what standard, you can still improve. Even Eamon could still improve, actually. I'm going on record and saying it.
You just got yourself fired before you were even hired for insubordination, Paul. I am curious, Martin. As George mentioned, you're north of 400 episodes here. Is there one tip where you got more positive viewer feedback from that over the years that just seemed to resonate with people more?
Well, that's a great question, Eamon. I would say the one tip that's probably had the most feedback of any was when my very clever producer, Brett Berlanti, I said, look, I want to imagine there's a swimming pool and I'm standing in a swimming pool about waist height. And in the downswing, I've got to get the hands in the swimming pool before the club head, because most people uncock the wrist too early and get the club head in the pool too early. And that's really resonated with people because they put some really nice graphics on the screen there. There's been a lot of things that people seem to remember. You know, we came up very early with right or rubbish in the first show. Is this statement right or is it rubbish? And people really like that, dispel it's sort of a myth buster, really. And Blair keeps setting me up for right or rubbish, and she does it beautifully. And, you know, she's been fantastic to work with, I have to say that. I mean, absolutely amazing to work with her. For all the swing thoughts I give her, that she can even pull the club back from the ball is actually miraculous.
That's the truly, truly incredible part of the show, if I do say so myself. And Blair, I mean, the show has taken you to so many different places. You've had all these different Hall of Fame guests.
Yes.
What for you is the most memorable?
Oh, I think going out to TPC Sawgrass, we filmed on 16, 17, and 18. Obviously, the floating green, that was amazing. Going out to Dave Pell's home, seeing his backyard. He's got all the putting greens and the chipping greens and the sand and such an amazing facility. We filmed from there. And then, you know, KPMG, one of the majors, we had Phil Mickelson on the show. And it was just going through a short game clinic. And I think that's one of, I think, my favorite episodes you can go back and really learn a lot from. So we've got to go a lot of really cool places and talk with, like you said, a lot of great golfers.
Martin, there's so much attention these days on Scottie Scheffler, even to the point where Padraig Harrington had a funny video last week where he was trying to imitate the footwork, the kind of little shimmy step that seems to be going on. Is there anything that the average recreational golfer can learn from Scotty's swing, particularly from the footwork?
Well, the footwork, I would say no. But, Eamon, I would say, I mean, I'm really fond of showing people Scotty Scheffler's swing, especially young players. Equally fond of showing them Sahith Theegala, because they're swings that most people say, ooh, I don't want to swing like them. It's like, yeah, well, you want to hit the ball like them, I'll tell you that. And John Jacobs always said to me, look, golf is what the ball does. And I've always remembered that. I mean, the wonderful man, John Jacobs. And at the end of the day, I would say how the swing looks is somewhat overrated. Everybody takes video of the swings on the cell phones these days, and everybody just dives into the black hole of YouTube to find the secret, the magic move that in three swings is going to add 45 yards to your drive. And it's all gibberish and nonsense. But, you know, when you watch someone like Scotty Scheffler, he has a fantastic control of how he takes the club head through the hitting area. And if someone said to me, what did Randy Smith do with Scotty Scheffler? It's like he helped him build a swing where the club face very rarely gets close to the path of his swing, so he can hit it really hard under pressure. And he's, I mean, the way he's been playing is, we haven't seen that very often in the history of golf for someone to be that dominant in almost every event he's played in. I wouldn't bet against him at the Masters, I'll tell you that.
I think I'm inclined to agree with that assertion, Martin. You'd be pretty foolish if you were betting against the world number one with how he's looked. And Blair, in the game of golf, so much is made about distance. We've seen it on the PGA Tour, LPGA Tour, changes made long-term to counter distance. Yet for the average amateur, they're always chasing distance. They're always wanting to add more. You're a two-time NCAA long drive champion, former world long drive competitor. Give me some advice for someone who wants to try and add some distance off the tee.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Everyone wants to get some more distance off of the tee. First off, I would say to watch School of Golf episodes, because we have a handful of episodes that are geared around hitting the long ball. But personally, for me, I feel like fitness is a really big part of that. Specifically, obviously, working out and training your body to protect your body down the road with, you know, trying to hit that long ball. But I think one of the specific muscles is the glutes, working on the glutes. If you can do exercises surrounding the glutes, it's going to kind of protect your golf swing, help everything else have power in your golf swing. And I think it also depends on the age of the golfer, too. I think if I'm playing golf with 60-year-old men, 50-year-old men, whatever it may be, or a woman, I think the golfer who has the most flexibility is going to hit the ball a lot further as well. So I think flexibility is also key depending on, you know, the age range of the golfer we're talking about.
Unfortunately for me, Georgia, flexibility is going in the opposite direction these days.
Martin, we got to work on that.
If I watch every episode of this 14th season, Martin, how much can you guarantee me that I'm going to be better by the end of it than I am right now?
I am stunned in silence on that one, Eamon. There are no guarantees in this game, unfortunately. I think what I would tell you is you wouldn't be short of ideas to try, I can tell you that.
That's the problem. I'm already not short of ideas to try, Martin.
Martin, finally, you're crossing the 400-episode threshold. Do you have a goal in mind, like as far as how long you'd like to try and take it?
No, I mean, I think Blair and I really enjoy doing it. We've got a great team behind us at Golf Pass, and, you know, as long as they want us to do it, I think we're going to keep doing it. As long as I can keep coming up with fresh information. It's just new packaging. I mean, the message of the way Bobby Jones hit a golf ball over 100 years ago isn't any different. The impact ballistics are no different than the requirements now, or basically no different. But I think if I feel I can describe it and people around the world enjoy it, I'm going to keep doing it. You know, one of the things that's been so gratifying, and Blair would support this, I think, is the reach on Golf Pass is staggering, how many people we touch around the world. I mean, initially it was America, then it was Europe, and now it's around the world. And, you know, a game that's been so good to me, the fact that I feel I can give back to the game with School of Golf and with Blair and help golfers that I'll never meet, and maybe it'll help their kids. I mean, that's incredibly rewarding for me.
And it's been amazing for us to see over the years. And of course, you can catch School of Golf streaming now, season 14 on Golf Pass. Blair, Martin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You are very welcome.